antennas are, say, a kilometer or whatever distance apart, how do I calculate the number of dBm that the receiver is going to see, and whether or not it's, you know, within range of that 60, minus 60 dBm sensitivity?
Okay. What I usually do in a case like this is start off with a back-of-the-envelope calculation of what's called power spread. Plus 30 dBm, you said, is your transmitter. Plus 30 dBm is 30 dB, 1,000 to 1 above 1 milliwatt. dBm is reference to a milliwatt. All decibel measurements are a ratio. It's only an exact amount of power when you create it in decibels with reference to a milliwatt. dBm. So one watt plus 30 dBm is your transmit power. Minus 60 dBm is a fairly yucky receiver. Good receivers, by the way, can go to at least minus 100 and beyond. So it's a fairly low sensitivity receiver in your example of minus 60. And 3 dB of gain on the transmitter and 3 dB gain on the receiving antennas. Wattage-wise, plus 60 and minus plus 30 and minus 60 is 90 dB apart. Add the 3 and 3 for the transmit receiver, another 6. So you have a power spread capability of 96 decibels. So if the free space between the transmitting antenna and the receiving antenna creates less than 96 decibel of free space loss, you've got communication. And you really should throw in a factor for the insertion loss of the transmission line that goes to the antennas. We won't go there. That's another simple offset, but it's one of the factors you got to worry about. Now, if the two antennas could see each other line of sight, there's no obstructions between the two, no earth curvature, no trees and whatever, a rather simple formula that will tell you how much free space loss you get is the following. Free space loss in decibels equals 36 plus 6.
Repeater, timeout.
I'll repeat that. Free space loss in decibels equals 36.6 plus 20 log F plus 20 log D. F is frequency in megahertz. D is distance in miles. 36.6 is just a constant. So loss of free space in decibels equals 36.6 plus 20 log F plus 20 log D. Let me plug in some numbers to give you an idea. Assuming I'm running at 1 megahertz. Let me make it 100 megahertz. The log of 100 for the F number is going to be log of 100 is 20. Did I do that right? Yeah, 20. 20 times 20 is 400. I'm doing something wrong. Oh, log of 100 is 2. There we go. 20 times 2 is 40. So you get 40 decibels of loss because of 100 megahertz. Assume that my distance was 1 mile. D is 1 mile. The log of 1 is 0. So the 20 log D turns out to be 0. Doesn't count. The 36.6 I add to that, I end up with 76.6. If I was operating at 100 megahertz and the distance was 1 mile between the transmitting antenna and the receiving antenna, let me drop. That formula says I would get 76.6 decibels. What you'll notice that's peculiar about radio propagation is you get most of the loss in the first mile. If I change the distance from 1 mile to 2 miles, take my word for it, you plug it into the formula, you get 6 decibels more loss every time you double the distance. So 76.6 decibels of loss for the first mile would become 82.6 decibels of loss with 2 miles of distance. And then 6 dB if I double that, it would become 88.6 dB of loss for 4 miles. Since your system is good for 96 dB of free space loss, I know that you're good for more than 4 miles, and I'm just calculating the numbers without adding the antenna gain. I think you're going to find that your system is good for 10 miles if it was truly free space. Life gets a lot more complicated. Let me drop. If you now have to start calculating what happens as a function of Earth curvature, foliage attenuation, blockages due to buildings and water towers, life gets a lot more complicated. And there are a couple of books that will help you on that, but you usually start off with the free space calculation first. If you can't make it in free space, you ain't going to make it. The best you're going to do is free space. Now, there's a slight exception to that. And you're at an HF frequency, and Mother Nature is giving you a great big mirror in the sky that you and I call the ionosphere. And if the sunspot cycle is doing the right things, so your ionosphere is doing a real good mirror reflection, you can get a huge amount of gain off of that mirror. And the 5-watt signal will allow you to talk to a guy in Cuba on 20 meters. As we find out tonight, it did take place. But you do the calculation for free space first. And if my free space calculation tells me that I've got, in your particular case, you've got 96 dB of spread, power spread. In other words, we added up all of the gains of your antenna, the gain of your transmitter, the power output of your transmitter, and receiver sensitivity, and we came with 96. And if for your particular range, if free space turned out to be 76, 96 was the power spread you can tolerate, 76 might be the number for free space range that you and I calculate for the right number of miles and that number of megahertz. The difference between 76 and 96 is 20 dB. Let me drop. That 20 dB of difference between your free space calculation and your power spread capability, I call it phase margin. Right? 96 dB was your power spread. 76 dB might be your free space calculated insertion loss. 20 dB is the difference between the two. You've got 20 decibels of fade margin. So by way of the attenuation you get from Earth curvature, foliage attenuation, blockage of trees and whatever, you can tolerate another 20 decibels of loss before you lose that signal. There's a hell of a lot more to it than this, Bill, but at least we're scratching the surface and we're beginning to answer your question, if you know what I mean. AC2IS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Thanks very much, Dick. This is AC2IS here. I think that's exactly what I was looking for. I just want to confirm that D is always in miles for this calculation. Wondering if the 36.6 has some easy rational explanation as to what that value is. I'm guessing it's just what happens to work. And I have one more question about if sensitivity is somehow not given in dBm, like a minus 60 or minus 80 or what have you dBm, but instead measured in fraction volt, how do you convert that to dBm?
Okay, the 36.6 comes about as a number that makes the equation work, and it really is a derived number. It's not an empirical measurement. It is a solution to the radar range equation. Distance in this formula is always distance in miles. You can make a very similar formula where the distance is in kilometers instead of miles. If you did that, the 36.6 becomes some other number, like 34 point something, if the distance is kilometers. By the same token, you can make the frequency gigahertz instead of megahertz, in which case the 36.6 becomes 96.6, as I remember. So the constant makes it all come out right when you choose your particular favorite system of units, frequency in megahertz or frequency in gigahertz, distance in miles or distance in kilometers, or distance in microfortnights if you want to use furlongs. Oh, here we go. In fathoms, you can use distance in fathoms if you want to, or yards, and just adjust that number out in front accordingly. But it is a solution of the radar range equation. That was one of your questions. I'm trying to remember what your second question is. Give me a hint as to the second question, Bill. Go ahead.
Sensitivity in volts as opposed to dBm.
Very good. One other rule of thumb that everybody remembers is that 1 microvolt is minus 107 dBm. If you happen to have a Hewlett-Packard 608 signal generator and you look at the dial, it goes down to a fraction of a microvolt. But 1 microvolt is minus 107 dBm. And 2 microvolts would be 6 dB louder than that, minus 101 dBm. So you could do it as a step-by-step procedure. If you want the exact calculation, you know that power is a function of voltage squared over resistance, E squared over R. I could literally take 1 microvolt, square it, divide it by 50, because the resistance over which you measured that 1 microvolt is usually a 50-ohm piece of coax cable. Let me drop. So if you want the exact calculation, you take the voltage in volts, square it, divided by the resistance in ohm, E squared over R, that is units of watts. Take those watts, multiply it by 1,000, because dBm is with reference to a milliwatt. Take 10 times the log of that calculated power, and you know dBm. So either you start off at 1 microvolt and scale it, or really go through that calculation. Does that make some sense, Bill? AC2IS, K2LIW.
Yes, Dick, I'm not sure I followed that very last bit, but if we're saying that 1 microvolt is equal to negative 107 dBm, I think I can make that work for me. Thanks very much.
Yeah, but and you can, if you now want to know 2 microvolts, 4 microvolts, 8 microvolts, and so on, and you change it by 6 dB each time because it's a function of voltage squared, that's why it's 6 dB, not 3 dB, you can get to the new number. But if you want to do it exact, somebody tells you that this particular signal is 67.41 microvolts. And now you're in a little bit of trouble. 67.41 microvolts. I convert the microvolts to volts. I square the volts. Divide by 50. That's power equals E squared over R. I now know the answer in watts. 67.14 microvolts squared as voltage. Convert the voltage first, square it, and divide by 50. I now know watts. Take those watts, multiply it by 1,000 to make it into milliwatts, because dBm is power with reference to milliwatts. So I multiply by 1,000. I've now converted my watts to milliwatts. Now I take the log of that. 10 times the log of that number of milliwatts is dBm. You can combine it all into one great big formula, where you can realize what you're doing step by step, then power is E squared over R, and calculate how many milliwatts that is, take 10 times the log of that, and you know dBm. And once you know dBm of signal that your receiver can receive, and you can work that backwards. If they tell you minus 60 dBm is the sensitivity, you can convert that by doing the whole process backwards. Let me drop. And that is, you can convert it to power by dividing by 10 and raising it to the anti-log, to the power of 10, to the exponent of 10. That converts it into milliwatts. Well, where are we trying to go with this now? Oh, I've got to convert dBm to volts, to microvolts. Just take my word for it, play the whole process backwards. I'd have to put it on paper to be able to do it. I normally do it forward, and I'd have to put it on a piece of paper to do it backwards, but I'm pretty sure with your mathematical background, Bill, you'll have no trouble working that process backwards once you can do it forward. Anybody with any further questions on how you calculate range that you should get out of a receiver and a transmitter? And let me give you one other example before I turn it over to you guys. Let me drop. You take a real good handy talkie made by Motorola. You put it in the hands of astronaut Owen Garriott. You put him on the space shuttle that was flying around 1985. I can't remember what space shuttle it was. And he's transmitting 5 watts into a fairly simple foil antenna that was taped to the window of the space shuttle while the space shuttle is flying upside down and the window is aimed down at space, down at the Earth. and he's flying over Texas, and his path is going to go from Texas toward New York. That was the path he was about to fly at this appointed period of time. So 5 watts from a handy talky, roughly 1,500 miles away, and I've got a very simple antenna, a 5/8 wave ground plane on my automobile in the parking lot of Airborne Instruments Laboratory. And this occurred at roughly noontime. So at noontime, I go out there, turn on my rig, tune to the right frequency, and there's Owen Garriott over Texas describing what he sees and transmitting. And I'm hearing him about 10 dB signal to noise ratio. A little bit noisy, but very clearly I'm hearing his voice. And of course, I start transmitting back to him, and nothing happens for a very good reason. From his perch up there, he's looking at a 1,500-mile radius of humanity, 3,000-mile diameter of humanity he's looking at simultaneously from his perch at 180 nautical miles or 160 nautical miles above the Earth. Let me drop. A good handy-talkie working correctly has a sensitivity of in the vicinity of a quarter of a microvolt. A quarter of a microvolt is, I think, something like 12 decibels better than minus 107. It's around minus 120 some odd dB of sensitivity. And he's transmitting 5 watts. You go through the numbers. Will you have free space range of 1,500 miles? The answer is absolutely yes. And I did manage to talk to Owen Garriott. But what did it take? The next day I came home, and with 4 Yagis aimed at him, on top of 100 foot of tower and 300 watts of power, he managed to hear me, finally, above all of that rabble. I'm competing with about 1,000 other guys shouting him at the exact same time. The problem in that case wasn't range. It was signal-to-noise ratio on the uplink, because he was being bombarded by thousands of people simultaneously. On top of that, when you listen to the tape recording that he supplied, if you went and bought that tape, you heard all kinds of squiggles and noises in there because he was listening to all of those radars, all of those broadcast transmitters and receivers. That handy-talkie was not made, even though it's a beautiful Motorola, high-quality handy-talkie, it was not made for that environment. Let me drop. You take that beautiful $3,000 Motorola handy-talkie, and you go to the observation deck on the 86th floor of the Empire State Building, and you think you're going to talk to your friend 40 miles away. By calculation, he should be 30 dB above your noise. And you go up there and you try to talk to him. He's going to hear you like gangbusters. He talks back to you at the 86th floor, and you hear nothing. That sounds like him. You'll hear a whole lot of stuff. But that 86th floor of the Empire State Building is one of the hottest pieces of real estate on planet Earth. It's got a whole lot of high-power broadcast transmitters, all transmitting 150 feet above you on that mast. And the amount of overload that receiver's going to get is just going to make it melt in your hand almost. That's exactly what was happening to Owen Garriott when he was on the space shuttle. What he needed is the world's best bandpass filter passing only 2-meter signals, because he was hearing everything from DC to light from his particular perch, if you know what I mean. Anybody got any further questions or comments on this? K2LIW on the TechNet.
AC2IS here.
Yeah, I'm going to pass it back to you in a minute, Bill. There's one of those comments I'll make to you. So, handy-talkie to handy-talkie, truly free space, space shuttle to ground, 1,500 miles can be covered, and it was. Now, you take your handy-talkie, and you get another one just like it, and what brand name almost doesn't matter, and you hand it to your friend and say, stop walking away from me, and we'll keep talking. You soon realize when he gets a mile and a half, you're on the ground, he's on the ground, he's walking away from you. There's all kinds of trees and buildings and everything else as he walks away from you, and he goes up and down this street and that street, and you might fall out of range at 1 mile because of what all that other attenuating stuff between you and him is doing. Do it mobile to mobile, where at least you've got an antenna with a little bit more gain than the rubber duck sitting on top of the automobile, a 5/8 wave mag mount on your automobile and 5/8 wave mag mount on his automobile, and you're both driving down the Lorient Expressway. You'll probably get 15 miles, if you're lucky, depending on the terrain, because of all the stuff that's in between you, called the multipath. When it comes to you from your handy turkey, or your higher power transmitter, maybe a 30-watt transmitter, your mobile, into that mag mount, talking to this repeater, you may get 30 miles, 40 miles on a good day, because it's on a nice high perch, repeating your signal to the guy that's over there in New Jersey, and now you've got a two-way communication because of what the repeater is doing for you. So as you can tell, in many circumstances, terrain becomes very dominant over a free space calculation. AC2IS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, I think you mentioned that to talk to the space shuttle, to this astronaut in the space shuttle, that you used four separate Yagis. Is that correct? And if so, why multiple antennas?
I needed all the ERP I could muster. There's 1,000 guys shouting at him simultaneously, and you got to climb above that rabble. 300 watts into four Yagis, or maybe it was two Yagis at the time, two Yagis where each one had a calculated 13 dB of gain, so two Yagis, 16 dB of gain, 16 dB is a 40-to-1 ratio, 40 times 300 watts, I think that was 12 kilowatts or 1.2 kilowatts. A number of kilowatts was my effective radiated power aimed directly at him in order for him to hear me. And when I bought that tape recording and I listened to my squeaky little voice above all that rabble, I was there and I got a QSL card from him, but I wasn't good for quieting. No chance in the world. The first few Americans he talked to were talking to him with moon-bound antennas. And that's about the state-of-the-art in effective radiated power. Many moon-bound antennas have close to 1 million watts of effective radiated power. So the first few QSOs were really running high power. When he talked to King Hussein in Jordan, when he was over that country, and I was the only man on the air, handy-talkie to handy-talkie, no sweat. But flying over the United States, which has got a lot of RF transmitters and a lot of ham radio operators, you've got one hell of a lot of competition. AC2IS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Let me know when you run out of time for questions, but I'm still not understanding why having two separate Yagis is better than having one Yagi with a given gain. You can't add the gain of two antennas by putting them in parallel, right?
Okay. The bedrock equation, gain equals 4 pi a over lambda squared. That is gain as a hard number. That's the equation that is the defining equation for all antenna measurements. If you're running an antenna range, you're going to be using that equation, whether you know it or not. If I'm using two Yagis side by side with the right spacing instead of one Yagi, I have just doubled the area of that antenna. You start with the transmitter, goes to a transmission line. That in turn goes to a 2-to-1 power divider. If I'm running 100 watts out of the transmitter, and at the top of the tower it goes into a 2-to-1 power divider, I'm putting 50 watts into the top antenna and 50 watts into the bottom antenna, assuming I'm vertically stacking a pair of Yagis. Yeah, I'm dividing the power that goes into two antennas. But I have doubled the area of the antennas. My gain just got 3 dB higher, and all the power that I'm radiating is radiating in one direction. I'm aiming both Yagis in the same direction. Every time you double the number of Yagis you're using, if they're properly stacked and properly fed, you go up 3 dB in gain. When I had 16 Yagis on 432, you Google my call letters, you'll eventually find a red QSL card which shows 16 Yagis on 432. Let me drop them. The front cover of that QSL card is a picture of 16 Yagis on 432 on top of 100 feet of tower and me standing in the middle of it. That array of 16 Yagis on 432, 19 elements each, 304 elements total, that antenna was 16 feet wide, 15 feet high, 13 feet deep, 3,500 cubic feet of antenna, sitting on top of 100 feet of tower, and me standing in the middle of it for the photograph. That antenna has 29 dB of gain. Every time you double the number of Yagis you're using, the gain of the antenna goes up by 3 dB. Every time you double the area, the gain goes up by 3 dB. Properly fed, it's a great big phased array of Yagi antennas. More antennas makes you louder, Bill. AC2IS, K2LIW, the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, I feel like I'm kind of monopolizing the airwaves now, so let me know if you want to answer another question or not. But I do have a question about a software-defined radio rig that I've got set up and an antenna that's connected to it. I'm getting, I can see my own local transmissions on the software-defined radio, but I'm not seeing anything back from the repeater. And I'm wondering if there's some explanation other than that sensitivity is very poor on the software-defined radio hardware.
Yeah, I'd let you ask a number of questions, Bill, because they're darn good questions, and even this one. However, our original schedule was we really should have the space portion of the TechNet. That's our usual menu, if you know what I mean. And by way of the Perseids Media Shower, that's taking place over the next couple of days. You guys really should be looking for it. The biggest media shower of the year is the Perseids Media Shower, and I think it's the 11th and 12th day of August, in which it's supposed to hit its peak. And that peak could be some really big blue wizards, as they say. So let me turn it over to Paul. WS2N, K2LI in the TechNet. Go ahead, Paul.
KC2WGB for quickie.
Go ahead, John.
Okay, Dick, I'm transmitting duplex now. I switched to my other one. I just wanted to see how it sounded. Okay, back to you, KC2WGB.
Are you running full duplex for the first time in your life? Are you hearing your own voice coming back through the repeater with a set of earphones? If so, congratulations.
Yeah, I switched to my other 2000. I figured, let me see what it sounds like. And I'm using a 7100 receiver to receive that, and it's working well, but I am overwhelming the receiver at times, so I'm going to have to do something about that. But okay, I just wanted to check.
Well done, John. Well done. Once you get used to it, you'll say, how in the world have I ever lived without it? Almost all of my QSOs on 2 meters from home are done by full duplex. As such, I know what my words got through and didn't get through, what's got to be repeated. It makes the conversation flow a hell of a lot nicer. The people who are listening to a net, they'd rather not listen to long periods of the net control operator finding out that his last 2 minutes of transmission, nobody heard it for whatever reason. And he could have corrected that in the first 5 seconds if he was running full duplex. WS2N, K2IW, go ahead, Paul, with a space portion.
Okay, Dick, on a note, I've tried it with the two different repeaters on 375, listening on an HT with an earplug, and the delay was, well, you know what it is, it's tough with the delay. All right, let me give you a report, Dick.
Go right ahead, you sound good.
Yeah, he was on Columbia, one of the earlier flights. I think it was 8 or 9, probably 1984, maybe end of 1983. But that was the first flight I remember, because they had the ham radio on board, and they had the Space Lab 1 in the back of the shuttle in the cargo bay. You might remember this thing. They flew this thing a number of times. So what they would do is you'd have your living quarters up front, and then you had a tunnel which you would leave, and you would go to the back, and you'd enter this room, maybe 10 foot long, and of course, you stand at 13 feet diameter, and that's where Owen Gary was. That's where he was transmitting with his ham radio, no doubt. I don't know how he was getting his signal through the space lab. I mean, there was a window there. Did you ever find out, was he in a cargo bay or in the space lab when he was transmitting there? What was HD?
I think it's the main window they look out of when they're doing an operation from the cargo bay. So that, I believe, was the window that he had taped an antenna to in order to do that operation. Now, go ahead.
Okay, yeah, they had the two windows they could look out in the back to the cargo bay, and in this case with the space lab back there, they'd be looking at the cylinder. But they, at the same time, there were other astronauts. There were six people that went on that flight, and there were other astronauts inside that cylinder. Space lab one, and that was pretty good. That was built between the European Space Agency and NASA, you know, a shared joint project. But it gave the shuttle a lot more room. You know, you got these flights with all these people on board, and you could at least maneuver. You know, you didn't have to stay cramped. They did run a couple of very cramped flights with six people all jammed up in the front, just with, you know, different experiments and pallets in the back that you couldn't go into, and that was a bit of a headache, I said. But that gave him a lot of room. Let me drop it. As far as future flights, I'm looking forward to, I know the Perseverance, yeah, that's tonight and tomorrow. They say at later, the better, probably 11, 12, 1, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, you might get to see one a minute, or as they report on the news, one every 70 seconds, so that's the average. Pretty good, especially if you've never seen this type of thing before. Personally, I'm not going to be doing it, but it's fun to do. Might be cloudy. Yeah, it was pretty cloudy all day. I don't know what it looks like out there now. You got one flight coming up I'm looking forward to in September. Beginning of September, I think September 6th, you've got the LADEE lunar launch. LADEE stands for Lunar Atmosphere and Dust Environment Explorer. So it's going to orbit the moon. We talked about this on the net before, but I'll do it again. It's going to orbit the moon very low. It's going to sniff out what tenuous atmosphere might be there. The scientists want to know this before we colonize the moon and screw everything up like we're good at. They want it in the pristine condition that it is now, and they're going to take some measurements. But it's going to be launched from Wallops Island, Virginia, and Orbital Sciences is the company that built the new rocket that they're going to use, the Minotaur 5. There are other Minotaurs, but this is a little bit bigger. And it's going to be the first lunar launch from this facility. So this is the facility that Orbital Sciences is using. They launched the Antares, their own rocket that they built a few months ago. And they'll be launching another one at the end of the year. Wait a minute, I think, I'll be a flight of two after, I'll be a flight of two after this lunar flight. I'll have to check the month on that. But they'll be launching a cargo mission to the International Space Station, this time using their own spacecraft that they built called the Cygnus. So the Cygnus will be mounted on top of the Antares rocket. Let me drop it. This is WS2N. So we're looking forward to that. It's going to take 30 days for the spacecraft to get there. It's not like the Apollo days where you would go make it in 3 or 4 days. This takes big loops. Loops get larger and larger until it eventually gets to the moon as it goes around the Earth, and then eventually goes into lunar orbit. And they'll have another 30-day checkout period and another maybe half a year of science. So it's not a big spacecraft. I think it's under 1,000 pounds. Produces a couple hundred watts. It's a small spacecraft, but interesting that it's going to be launched by a private company, Orbital Sciences, and from their new facility in Wallops Island. Wallops Island has been around a long time, but it's new to them. They kind of like renovated their launch facility. The whole platform and everything is all new, built by Orbital Sciences. Part of the private corporations getting involved with space travel. Let me drop it. And the other thing in the news is the H2 cargo vessel that launched last week. I mentioned that on the internet. From Japan, has now docked with the International Space Station. And it carries more supplies than the Progress spacecraft, a little bit more than twice the supply capability. It doesn't go off as often as the Progress spacecraft, but in the long run, it's about the same. Probably a 2-to-1 ratio with these Japanese modules going up, and they don't recharge our Earth. They also get burnt up in the atmosphere. But they did dock it. They docked it to what's called a common berthing mechanism. It's a port on the Harmony node. And if you want, I can explain the whole, I've tried to do this before, the whole layout of the space station. It's pretty interesting. On all the different modules and all the different truss sections put together to hold the solar panels. It's quite a project. I think it's up to around $150 billion project, with all the 16 countries involved. Now, the reason I mention the common berthing mechanism that the Japanese H2 is docked to is that same one that the Dragon was docked to, and will also be the same one that Cygnus will be docked to when that goes up. And why is it important? Well, if you ever see it, it's mounted, it's part of the Harmony node. There's three nodes. Nodes, what they are, each one is a big cylinder, and each one has six ports on it. So if you're looking at a Coke can, the front and back, and then that would be two, and then you've got four coming out of the sides. So the total of six for each node, and these are interconnecting parts for all the different modules on the space station. And what you have is, this one happens to be node two. They name them as they go up. This one's called Harmony. The first one was called Unity. And the third one is called Tranquility. But Harmony is the one that they use for all the docking purposes now. It was used on the last, quite a few of the last shuttle missions. Out of the front of Harmony, the run of Harmony, they have a docking, a pressure mating adapter. It's a docking piece that's mounted to it. And that's the one that they use for all the shuttles. Drop it. Shuttle needed this type of an arrangement to dock. Shuttle had a system of big cylinders coming out of the back of the cargo bay, and that's what actually docked with the space station and with Mir when they were doing that. But to do that, you need this extension piece, and they use these pressure mating adapters to do it. And what they have is, you dock to it, and then you can open up the inside door and the outside door, and you can eventually get to the space shuttle. Now that the program has been canceled, you don't need this anymore. In fact, there's three of them up there, these pressure mating adapters. One of them has been permanently connected to the space station. It was part of the first two pieces that were put together by the Azaria functioning cargo bus. node, the first node that had gone up. Between those two was the first pressure mating adapter. The second one is the one that I'm talking about now, presently located on the Harmony node. Let me drop it. And then it's the third one that they used for a while, and now they're not using it. That's right now it's mounted on the Tranquility node, of no use right now. In fact, nobody would be able to dock with it. There's different, and there's antennas in the way, and then there's the radiating panels that are also in the way. So what they have is this docking unit that is really seems to be of no use. The Dragon is docking with it now, with underneath it right now, not using that, you know, into the side, or actually the zenith of the, correction, the nadir of the Harmony node. So they want to use the, they'd like to see, you know, other spacecraft dock to this thing. It would give them another port. The Dragon is now being contracted to bring this other mechanism up that will work with Dragon, and it will work with other spacecraft like Cygnus, or it will work with the Boeing spacecraft that they're building, which will have also have astronauts on board, and they'll have another docking port. But here the commercial guys are getting involved again. SpaceX will be bringing up this adapter that's going to go on to this pressure mating adapter that is no longer in use. Interesting enough, on the American side, on the Russian side, this WS2N, on the Russian side, they have right now they have four different places where you could park vehicles. You could put a couple of Soyuz spacecraft up there, which they have now, because there are people on board. You need, according to flight rules, an escape route. So you have to have these spacecraft Soyuz, spacecraft hold three each. So on these, all these different docking modules, which are four, you've got those two, and then you have like a Progress spacecraft, cargo vehicle, also docked in, and another one that remains open that recently they had the ATV, the automatic transfer vehicle, big cargo vehicle from European Space Agency was docked to that. So, turns out at the end of the year, the Russians are actually sending up one more assembly piece. Is the space station done? No, it's an ongoing project. They plan on sending up this other scientific lab. Also, it's got a facility inside where you could do spacewalks, and they're going to attach this to the space station. So where are they going to put it? They're going to put it where the Pier's docking module is. Now, Dick, you've asked many, many times in the past, what about deorbiting the space station? By the end of this year, because this module is going up probably in December, maybe November, by the Russians, and it's a big unit. I mean, they're not going to put it up on a Soyuz rocket, which they normally launch the Soyuz spacecraft or the cargo rockets, the Progress. They're going to put it up on a Proton rocket, which is their heavy lift vehicle, and it will automatically dock with the space station. But they're going to do away with this Pierce docking unit, and it's also a port that they've been using for EAVs on the Russian side. And they're going to hook it up to a Progress spacecraft, or one way or another, and then they're going to deorbit it. So that would be actually the first piece of the 100 million pound, correction, 1 million pound International Space Station that will deorbit. And that's pretty much it. I just wanted to go over that. If you ever want to hear the construction of this thing, how it's all put together, let me know. I'll go through it step by step. I've tried it before, but we could always do it again. Dick, over to you. This is WS2L.
Hi, thank you, Paul. And I'll turn it over to the net if anybody has any further questions for you. Before I do, give you guys a couple of words about the Perseus meteor shower. Why should you listen when? Or why should you look when? Assuming you've got clear sky. If you looked at our whole solar system top view, you could say the Earth goes around the Sun counterclockwise. Earth spins on its axis counterclockwise. Therefore, we're traveling at something like 19 miles per second in our orbit round the Sun. So the Earth is moving pretty fast, thousands of miles an hour. And as we go around in that orbit, the leading edge of the Earth, the most forward portion of the Earth, is the part that you see right at sunrise. You're on the leading edge of the Earth as it goes around the Sun counterclockwise. And that's just at the instant of time that the Sun off to one side is just giving you sunrise. You're on the back end of the Earth, as far as its motion around the Sun is concerned, at sunset. At midnight, you're on the part of the Earth that's on the opposite side from the Sun. Let me drop. So the meteors you're going to encounter, in general, are just starting to come at you edgewise at midnight. They get stronger and stronger in quantity, in general, as you go toward sunrise. A quarter of a turn later, 6 more hours later, one turn for 24 hours. So you can see how you can still see a couple of meteors at the sunset, but they've got to wrap themselves around the Earth because of your velocity, if you know what I mean, in order to get to you. And those are rare ones. As you get closer and closer to sunrise, in theory, everything else being constant, you're going to see more and more of them. But of course, the sky is starting to get bright because of sunrise, and therefore, you're not going to see them. Radio-wise, they're there. If you're doing a meteor scatter communication, let me drop. In theory, you're going to have the maximum number of meteors to talk to at sunrise. And in theory, they won't fade away until sunset. But optically speaking, probably midnight to, let me pick a number, 3 or 4 a.m. is going to be the maximum number you're going to see if everything else was equal. And the nice thing about this particular, something Tuttle is the name of the actual comet that broke into pieces and results in the Perseus meteor shower. It has that name because it appears to come from that constellation, the particles that you see. And these are big particles, and they're moving toward the Earth at some ridiculous velocity, and we're moving toward them at almost equal velocity. You could call it a head-on collision of two fast-moving objects. That's the reason why these meteors are the fastest, the biggest, therefore the brightest, and it's the best meteor shower you're ever going to see in general. I wonder if anybody listening to us has seen any Perseus meteors in the last few days. This particular meteor shower did begin earlier, but it's just the outer edge of it, so to speak. Has anybody within the sound of our voice seen any significant meteors so far? If so, give me a call. That is right now. KQIIW in the thick man.
From Gravenhurst. From Gravenhurst. DE3JIW.
Very fine. DE3JIW. Jim. Gravenhurst, Canada, I presume. Is that a town that's part of the Golden Horseshoe of Canada? And tell us what you saw, Jim. VE3JIW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I'm in a perfect spot. I'm 110 driving miles north of Toronto. Probably 85 miles crow fly, north of Lake Ontario. So I'm in an area of lakes very much like the Adirondacks. Same type of boat, same type of people. And so I'm out in a small lake last night, about till 10:30, and I let my boat drift, and I saw two good, well-lit streaks running sort of north to south. Their trajectory aims at, they finish entering the Earth at about where the sun sets in December. Think position on the shore, sort of north to south. And I stayed around for a while and saw no others, and I'm going to have an opportunity tonight to sit in the boat for a while and watch for them.
Wow, wow. So if I understand you correctly, Jim, you go out there in your boat where it's nice and dark. Hopefully the sea is calm. Lake Ontario is nice and calm. You're not that far offshore, I'm guessing. Maybe you put down an anchor, maybe you don't, and drift, and I'm guessing you've got an outboard motor on that boat. And you sit and look at the stars, lay down in the bottom of the boat and look straight up, is my guess. Well, I put you into a rowboat. You're probably into a party boat or something a little bit bigger. And you're probably going to go out there after the TechNet ends. Wonder how long you stayed last night, how long you stayed tonight, and what kind of weather are you having, Jim? VE3JIW, K2RIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Jim.
Okay, I'm not on Lake Ontario. I'm 100 miles north in what area that resembles the Adirondacks very much. Pine trees, small lakes. We call them cottages, like a home away from home. So, no, I'm on a small lake, so I can safely drift. I don't need to anchor. Well, if it's windy, I guess they have to anchor, but no. It's over 60. It's probably not clear. I haven't looked outside. I think I'm dealing with heavy clouds tonight. So, I'll probably see nothing tonight. It was cloudy earlier. But no, I'm 100 miles north of Lake Ontario, near north, cottage country. Similar to the Adirondacks, I think. We went through the Adirondacks, spent nearly a week there. Seemed similar.
If the weather was clear enough, how late would you stay, Jim? And do you have to go to work the next day? Back to you, Jim.
Okay, I just stepped out again and I can see stars. The sky has cleared. No, I have to do a two-hour drive back to Toronto. And I have an appointment for my wife in the morning, but I can spend another couple of hours, eventually meander the way home. I was actually staying, you know, planning to stay up here, listen to the net locally, and then get on the road. So I don't have a schedule for the morning other than accompanying my wife on an errand.
Okay, I've got two questions for you. Number one, is there a local repeater by way of Echolink or whatever that you can listen to the TechNet while you're driving? I know that we've got a guy on Long Island who drives through the Midwest and talks to us back on something like Echolink from his cell phone. Not quite sure how old John is doing that. K2UPS does that. That's question number one. And question number two, you watched a nice bright meteor or two last night. You watch them burn up. There's a nice bright streak across the sky. That burn-up process that meteor did a lot of heating as it hit the atmosphere at something like 380,000 miles an hour. What do you believe, Jim, was the mechanism by which that meteor burned up? What created all of that heat? VE3JIW, K2RIW.
I've got about four repeaters here that I could get IRLP, and I could make it to Toronto by switching machines on the way. Okay, 380,000 miles an hour. It's building up incredible pressure, the air in front of it. Compressed air, its temperature is going up. So I think it's due to the compressing of the air in front of the meteor, and I think there's friction in the air also. But I think it's compressing of the air in front of it. Maybe you'll tell me more.
As I sometimes say down here, Jim, give that man a cigar. You gave the most rare answer, Jim, and you gave the correct answer. It's the compression wave in front of the meteor, PV equals NRT, that's creating all of that heating pressure. For all practical purposes, not one single air molecule struck that meteor. A lot of people have a lot of trouble with that. Most people say, oh, it's the friction. Well, that's an overly simplistic answer. It's not really friction. All the air in your room is bouncing around at 500 meters per second, and it does not touch the walls. It comes very close. and the cloud of electrons around each air molecule create a great big strong electrostatic negative charge. The cloud of electrons around each wall molecule create a real strong electrostatic negative charge. And those two charges have such strong repulsion that when those air molecules come close to that wall, they make a perfect bounce off the vicinity. They come close to the wall but never touch it. Those air molecules never touch that meteor. You have to take particles up to near the speed of light in a particle accelerator before they finally have enough velocity to penetrate that outer shell, a very strong electrostatic charge. For some reason, very few people seem to know that. It's not taught in our schools. Maybe it's somewhat taught in the Canadian schools, because you had the right answer. Where did you get that right answer from, Jim? VE3JIW, K2RIW, and the tech man?
Well, I got a trip because I didn't wait long enough. Okay, so, this is getting on 9 months of knowing about the TechNet. Before the TechNet, I didn't know about the average velocity, or speed, or velocity. Not really velocity, but if you add it all up, probably equals zero. But molecules at room temperature, how fast they're moving, that was new to me from listening to the TechNet. And I do know that air compressing, you compress air, you get a lot of heat, and it's not really friction for piston and cylinder. So it's an interesting word to pronounce, apneatic. As you compress air, the temperature goes up. So I think it was just putting things together. It wasn't something that really covered in school. But I would attribute some of it to just listening to this net.
Wow. Hey, John, we got to send him a bill. Adiabatic compression. I think it's the one that means compression without extracting the heat. So if the walls are not absorbing heat from the gas inside, I think that's called adiabatic compression. Or is it isothermal compression? I'm not sure. We'll eventually find that one. And you ask the average guy, why does the front end of a high-speed airplane get hot? Why does a meteor burn up? Why does the bottom of your bicycle pump get hot? And quite often they can give you an answer of how much, but they can't tell you why. And so, to me, the next step of the understanding, which is not taught in our schools at times, is useful information. You give a person a piece of information that, with all good scientific measurements, appears to be the truth, someday he's going to find a way of using it. The truth never hurts. Let me drop. And so the closer we get to the truth, the better as I see it. Okay, glad you checked in. Glad you saw some nice meteors. And for the guys who do meteor scatter ham radio, they sometimes build up some very nice range by aiming their antennas in the right direction at the right time with the right procedure. That ionization trail is quite reflective. However, the magnitude of the reflection you get goes down as frequency, 1 over frequency cubed. You go to either square or cube, I think it's cube. You get a much bigger reflection on 6 meters than 2 meters. I believe people have done meteor scatter in 220, and I think there was one or two events, very few events, of meteor scatter in 432. But 1296, I think it's essentially impossible. And the duration that you get a echo from the meteor goes down very fast as you go higher in frequency. It takes higher ionization density to reflect a higher frequency radio signal. Someday I'm going to find out why that takes place. I'm not quite sure why yet. Okay, now, Wes did have an email he sent us in which he wants us to look at a new breakthrough in which the scientists at, let's see now, which location was it? University of, let's see, New Brunswick, is it? Austria? No, American.
There's two of them, Dick.
Yeah. New South Wales and Purdue University, apparently.